the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Thursday, January 29th. And we have four bills on our schedule, plus a couple of committee measures to introduce. And I'll open by beginning a public hearing on Senate Bill 124 and asking...
Do you want to do the introductions, or do you want to...
No, we'll start with public hearing on Senate Bill 124 and ask Mr. Stembridge to give us a summary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 124 changes the class of offense of operating a motorcycle without a motorcycle endorsement from a Class B to Class A traffic violation. It increases the maximum penalty from $360 to $720. Included in your packet the statute that lists the classes of violation and the associated penalties.
Okay, and we'll ask David Peterson from the Governor's Committee on Safety to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, my name is David Peterson. I'm a vice chairman of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. Senate Bill 124 increases the penalty for riding a motorcycle without an endorsement. Currently, it is a Class B violation with a $360 maximum fine. This bill will increase the violation class to A and double the fine to $720. With this change, there would be a reduction in the number of motorcyclists riding without an endorsement. These unlicensed riders are not only a risk to themselves, but to other drivers as well. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety believes that unlicensed and untested motorcyclists should incur a more severe penalty for endangering themselves and others. Motorcyclists riding without an endorsement have been overrepresented in Oregon motorcycle fatal and injury crashes for quite some time. In 1981, a study by the Oregon Traffic Safety Commission noted that 27% of motorcycle operators studied had no endorsement. Motorcycle crashes in Oregon have risen from 543 in 2002 to 743 in 2007. 272 motorcyclists have died in crashes since 2003, and 26% of these fatalities were unendorsed. Almost 30 years is too long for this trend to continue. Receiving an endorsement implies that some training or proficiency has been attained, and proficiency matters. In 2007-2008, 61% of the fatalities were single vehicle accidents, and fault was attributed to the motorcyclist in 77% of the cases. An endorsement validates a minimum proficiency of that may save a life. Data demonstrates that the current fine for riding without a motorcycle endorsement may not be effective. Of 895 riders convicted from 2005 to 2007, 51, or fewer than 6%, subsequently got endorsed. In 2007, the committee identified over 12,000 people in Oregon who own a motorcycle but don't have an endorsement. They were sent a letter encouraging them to get endorsed. Special training classes were set up to accommodate the group. 5% followed through and acquired their endorsement. This is a start, but it is not enough. The committee held statewide public forums on this and other motorcycle safety-related topics throughout 2008. The majority of public testimony indicated clear support for increasing the penalty. We need to send a clear message to the motorcycling community about the importance of testing and training for all motorcyclists. The cost to acquire a motorcycle endorsement is $77 if one simply goes to the DMV and passes a skills test. Take the Team Oregon Basic Rider Training, which we strongly encourage, and the cost is $256. Some riders may risk riding without an endorsement because the difference in cost between the maximum penalty and the an endorsement is only $104. The committee proposes this bill to widen the gap so that there is a $464 difference. Perhaps then more motorcyclists may choose to see the cost benefit of attaining an endorsement. In conclusion, there are currently too many motorcyclists in Oregon riding without an endorsement. Senate Bill 124 will increase the penalty. The low rate of post-conviction compliance, a relatively small difference in cost between the current penalty and obtaining an endorsement, and the low rate of response to prior countermeasures has led to an untrained and untested motorcyclist on the public roads. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety supports Senate Bill 124 and asks that this committee support it as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, and thank you for serving on the advisory committee. I haven't had any personal experience with the committee. Would you mind telling me just a little bit, you know, who the different folks or organizations that serve on the committee with you?
Sure. The committee is consists of seven individuals that are appointed for four-year terms. I'm a relatively new member of the committee. I've been involved since February of last year. And we come from all walks of life, all up and down the Willamette Valley. Most of us are along the I-5 corridor.
Okay, but does the representation besides geographic, do you represent different stakeholder groups or just?
No. Motorcyclists from all different walks of life, but no particular stakeholders.
I see.
That are specifically represented.
Okay, well, thank you, sir.
Sure.
First of all, questions for Mr. Peterson. Senator Starr.
Thank you. I have a question. Your one statistic that you have in the fourth paragraph talks about the number of crashes that has increased since 2002.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't the amount of motorcycle owner, I mean, hasn't the number of motorcycles that people own, hasn't that risen as well? I mean, motorcycle ownership, use, hasn't that also gone up? So wouldn't it also mean then that the tread that you'd have, you have more riders, you have more motorcycles, you'd have more accidents?
No, that's true. And in fact, in 2008, the fatality rate actually dipped from where it was in 2007. But you're right, as a percentage of total registrants, yes, fatalities, in fact, probably have gone down. Although new motorcycle sales and new registrations tends to be rolling over right now with the economy.
That would make sense. Thank you.
But you're right.
Any other questions for Mr. Peterson? Senator George.
Since our goal is to get people to actually take the class and become trained, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be smarter to go ahead and raise it up to a Class A, but if you take the class, you get out of the conviction. I did it actually. I got a speeding ticket in Alaska one time because they said I was driving too fast in a Volkswagen Rabbit. They said I was going to hit a moose. So I had to go to the Alaska School of Defensive Driving, got out of the ticket. It was a very big motivation for me to go to defensive driving
sure.
classes. And all I'm saying is that it seems like to me that people get the ticket, you need to give them a motivation to go take the class. And I'm saying just giving them a big, huge fine doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to take the class.
Well, I'm not an expert in what the judiciary would enforce this, but I would tend to agree with you.
Okay.
You know, we want to make the stick a little bit bigger, but if the carrot is that a judge might be inclined to waive the fine because there's quick compliance, I think there's probably room within the law for that to occur. I would encourage that personally.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So did you get a moose avoidance class?
Yeah, yes. The state trooper pulled me over. I was in a little 1980 VW Rabbit, and he pulled me out of my car and made me sit in his trooper vehicle and gave me this half-hour lecture about how up in Alaska they have these big animals called moose. And it was about as condescending as you can get, but apparently they crushed a lot of small rabbit cars at the time. So.
Yeah.
So I learned my lesson. I went to Alaska School of Defensive Driving and never hit a moose. So from my perspective, it worked.
Alaska is a big destination for motorcyclists, so the moose issue is one we're all sensitive to.
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. President, I'm going to ask you to stay up there. We have just two other people signed up. I'll have them come up on either side just in case we have questions and you don't have to come back and forth. Steve Garretts is signed up, and Nick Oliver. And we'll start with Nick, and then we'll go to Steve. How's that?
Oh, runaway chair. How you doing? My name's Nick Oliver. I'm the Executive Director for Bike Pack of Oregon, Recording Secretary for ABATE of Oregon, Inc. And right now on Senate Bill 124, we support and we don't support it.
I noticed that you signed up for for and against. You could be a legislator.
Well, my concerns are very simple. I have no problem with training. In fact, we promote training very heavily. We also have the motorcycle awareness program that goes into the high schools and trains automobile drivers to be aware and share the road with motorcycles. But I think this is carrying it too far. I think if we're going to do this, we should have a graduated program. Similar to what you were talking about, you know, giving you a break on it. Give them one shot. If they get hit, they get training, kind of like a diversion program, we'll let it slide. You don't, get caught again, slam them. It's, you know, it's a very simple thing. The amount of motorcycles on the road have quadrupled in the past 4 years. It's amazing how much gas prices can affect people wanting to go out and get those really nice bikes that get real good gas mileage. Plus, they're much more environmentally friendly. You know, tiny little tires compared to great big monsters. So it makes a big difference in a lot of ways. But I also noticed in reading through this, most of it says operate a vehicle. But at the very top, at the start, it says motorcycle. So what is this going to, is this a parity issue or what? Because everybody should be trained, whether they're driving a car, whether they're riding a motorcycle, a moped, scooter. Everybody should have training. And it, without training, you don't know a lot of what you're facing. Plus, there's another issue that, that I don't think has been taken into account. If you, you have a minimum skills test, you have to take a DMV. So somebody goes in there for that. If that passes, you've got your endorsement. Well, Team Oregon goes way beyond that and teaches you much greater skills than that minimum skills thing can teach you. I took Team Oregon after 17 years of riding. This was quite a few years ago, but I took it and I learned things. There's no way you can get around learning, but at the same time, I don't see the reason to push this hard that fast. Some people are going to be stubborn. There's no way around it. You're going to have some people that just going to buck the system no matter how you do it. It doesn't matter, you know, whether it's motorcycles or cars or what. It really doesn't matter. You got some people that are going to... This needs to be make sure it's fair and equitable across the board and promote training and not promote penalties. That should be the... Exactly what it is, a penalty. But encourage them to get the training and get some kind of break. And that's our official position on it.
Thank you, Nick. I think I'll go to Mr. Garrett, and we'll open to questions for these other two gentlemen.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee. I'm Steve Garrett, the director of the Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Program. And before you have my testimony, unlicensed and unendorsed riders continue to represent a significant number of motorcycle fatalities in Oregon. The preliminary statistics from 2008 indicate that about 17% of the riders killed in motorcycle crashes in Oregon were not properly licensed. Team Oregon believes that the current penalty for riding a motorcycle without endorsement is not sufficient to encourage riders to become properly licensed. Other efforts to encourage proper licensing, for example, the instance, the letters sent directly to unendorsed riders that David talked about from the Governor's Committee in 2007, met with little success. This is a persistent problem. I'm aware of no initiative to improve compliance with existing licensing laws that has achieved sustainable success. Even after receiving convictions for no endorsement, most riders continue to ride unendorsed. Team Oregon is Oregon's motorcycle safety program, sponsored by ODOT and Oregon State University. We offer two motorcycle training courses that are approved by ODOT for the license waiver. The basic rider training program, it's 15 hours required of all riders under the age of 21, and although anybody over the age of 21 can take it. Successful completion of the BRT waives both the DMV skills and written tests. The intermediate rider training, the IRT, is an 8-hour program, waives the DMV skills test for successful graduates. The cost of these classes range from $125 for the IRT to a maximum of $179 for the BRT. The cost of both courses includes the use of training motorcycles and helmets if the riders don't have one. We believe that the fine for riding without a proper endorsement should be severe enough to encourage riders to become properly trained and licensed. In 2008, almost 10,000 students participated in one of Team Oregon's training courses. Of those, 8,207 Oregon riders successfully completed the BRT or the IRT, paving the way for proper licensure. This represents over half of the 14,268 motorcycle endorsements that DMV issued in 2008. We strongly believe that the training provided by Team Oregon has had a significant effect in lowering the number of motorcycle crashes and fatalities. In 2007, the most recent year for which national statistics are available, the national rate of motorcycle fatalities was 7.23 per 10,000 registrations. I want you to note Oregon's. In Oregon, the fatality rate for 2007 was 3.89 per 10,000 registrations. That's roughly half of the national average. Additionally, the preliminary statistics for 2008 indicate the number of motorcycle fatalities in Oregon dropped by nearly 10% from 2007. So in summary, we strongly believe that training and proper licensing can have a significant effect in lowering the number of motorcycle crashes and fatalities. We believe that by increasing the penalty for riding without a motorcycle endorsement can be effective in encouraging riders to become properly licensed. We support Senate Bill 124 and ask the committee also support this bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee for our other guests? Senator Stark.
I'd like to get the response from all the panel on Senator George's idea. So you get pulled over for not being properly, you're not properly endorsed, you get a ticket. So it's your first shot, you get the opportunity to go get the endorsement or you pay a $720 fine. Is that something that if we were to amend that bill, that language into this bill, would it still have your support?
Senator Starr, it could if it was uniformly applied. In the past, it's not. And what we've looked at in the numbers that have people who have received conviction, a handful of those people that are already convicted of that go on to get their endorsement. If that was uniformly applied, I'd say yes. If that was written in so that the courts would have that as a requirement or a rule in which they could follow, I would say yes.
So but the guy has two choices. You pay. I don't know, less than $300 to get endorsed, or you pay $720 fine.
I would agree with that. I would be in favor of that.
Senator George?
We might even take one step and not just get the endorsement, but maybe go through the actual training course.
Yeah.
So, you know, just don't take the written test and get your endorsement, but actually go through training, which is ultimately what we're trying to do here.
Exactly. I would agree with that. Again, if it's uniformly applied, but the different jurisdictions don't necessarily apply things uniformly, and so it's not consistent.
If we wrote it in statute, I think they might have to.
There you go.
Any other questions? I think we have a pathway here. I mean, as both Senator Starr and Senator George pointed out, and I appreciate your thoughts on that, because the end result, always looking at the public good, is that when you're out there and you're on a bike or in a car, you want the guy on the bike to know what they're doing, not only for their own safety, but your safety. And that's what we're trying to get to. So the idea is we want them properly trained and endorsed. And we use penalties to try to encourage them to do that, not because we're trying to collect the revenue from it. We want them back on knowing how to operate their bike. So I think what we'll do here, and if this is, I'll look for nods from the committee, and that the understanding that the current fine is not enough motivation to get the end result, which is get qualified on your bike, is to look at amending the bill to include the fines that you mentioned, but which would be mandatory. So that all jurisdictions would apply that, but if they get the training and endorsement, that would be then waived. So the idea being, let's get these people, let's move the statistic up from these minor people who say, well, I'd rather just pay a few bucks and still not get the training and endorsement. That way we do have, as Senator George pointed out, the end result, which is getting more qualified people safely operating their bike and for the rest of the motoring public. Would that be a way we achieve the result here if we do this?
Senator Metzger, I would agree with that uniformly, as long as we understood there was going to be prompt compliance. You know, this is really, I understand what Nick is saying, and we agree with the issues that are involved, and we do acknowledge that this is the stick and the carrot and stick approach. What you're talking about is the carrot. We just want compliance,
right?
Because even if you go to DMV on your own and forego training, you have to have some modicum of knowledge to a proficiency to take the basic ALTMOST test that they offer at the DMV. The people that have avoided getting an endorsement haven't even bothered to do that much.
Right.
In many cases, for many years. We just think that, you know, you've got to start somewhere. And compliance with the endorsement qualification is going to enhance ridership on the road.
Right. Just one more question for Steve is then on your shorter term endorsement. You know, you have the two layers. What is the time frame for that, and how often are those classes held?
We offered 980 courses last year, and we're on schedule to do at least that many this year and train close to 10,000. So we're training statewide every weekend, started last weekend.
So basically it's a weekend activity.
Yeah, it's a weekend activity.
So I'm just getting to your point, is that, you know, we could put in so many days, you know, within 120 days, 90 days. I mean, and it would be easy for them, because you do them every weekend, to be able to at least get that training and the proper endorsement.
And it's available all over the state.
Well, I think those were excellent suggestions by the committee. If that's what we'll do, we'll work with council to draft that, to use the carrot and the stick approach, and achieve what we hope would be greater compliance with training, but provide opportunities for either choice.
Very good.
Hey, we'll bring the bill back with that. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
That's the only one set to testify. I'm going to close public hearing 124. We'll bring that bill back, and appreciate the great work by the committee on that. I think we're going to get somewhere.
Thank you, Senator.
Let's open up public hearing on Senate Bill 125. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 125 requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to reimburse commercial driver training schools for traffic safety education courses certified by the department. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2009.
Okay, that's Mr. I can see with the, you know, the, it's bolded on my sticker here. We haven't seen you for a while, Troy. Troy Costales, Safety Division, ODOT. Why don't you kick this testimony off for us, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you, Mr. Stembridge, for the introduction of the bill. This does direct ODOT and the Safety Division to bring about the opportunity for current privately owned commercial driving schools the opportunity to take part in the student subsidy that exists today to help with lowering the fee and accessibility for teens to take driver education around the state. Currently, a teen to move from permit to the first part of the provisional license must do 50 hours of driving time with an adult, and then secondly, an additional 50 hours with that adult or an ODOT-approved course. Courses are being taught all over the state from community colleges, educational service districts, high schools, and commercial privately owned driving schools. The private driving schools have the opportunity to be under contract for all or part of the program to a public entity, or, as was authorized by the legislature a few years ago, the ability to actually have the program available straight up right through them as a private entity. However, where the inequity comes in is that my office does underwrite and subsidize for the public sector around the state up to $210 per pupil. At the end of the year, a check is given to that public entity to help lower the cost and make it so there's a break even at the public sector side. The private companies, if they're doing it on their own, they do not take part in that subsidy. It also, the way the law is written, is I have a struggle to help them out in relationship to instructor training, in relationship to some supplies, because by the law, they are outside my ability to do the subsidy. And so what this does twofold is allows an option, if that private company would choose to be part of that subsidy program, and second, it would allow me to be able to help them out to help underwrite some of their instructor training, in order to bring them and keep them on par with all 450 or so instructors that are around the state. Driver education works, and there's some information attached to my testimony about the dramatic reduction
of 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone's killed or injured, as well as 17-year-olds, and that's a compound of between the provisional licensing as well as driver education. We've had national study on our program that has shown that it works as well. It's making a difference. The attempt of this bill, from a policy point of view, for you to debate, is do we bring all of the players that are teaching these kids to drive, meeting or exceeding the current standards, all have access to the student subsidy to help mom and dad when they pay for the course, and also to help me help those private entities with the ability to help them on training and potential supplies for their program. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any of the questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Costales. Questions for Troy? Senator Starr.
Do we have statistics on how many kids are trained through the private side as opposed to going through either the ESTs or community colleges on a percentage basis?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I do not have that information because at this point in time, if an individual was to go through the private company, they don't have to report to me. They are noted as an approved program, and that student, that teen, can take that certificate directly to DMV as part of their licensing process and show it to the DMV staff that they've done that. But they're not required to report to me because there's no financial tie or reporting requirement. They just have to meet or exceed the curriculum and instructor standards.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. Is this a budget issue? Do you have plenty of money in the budget to basically broaden the reach of the program so you could support more schools?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, this is a budget issue. I believe this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Our estimate is that we would see the initial start of maybe up to 500 students via the private companies that choose to do this because they're not required. So roughly 210,000 is what I'm saying within the safety division budget, a line item to allow me to reimburse those private companies. It does not exist in the budget proposal today. So it does have a referral. From a revenue point of view, $6 of every driver license or renewal that we all do for Oregon goes to the Student Driver Training Fund, earmarked for my division to use for this program. Currently, there is $8 million in that account. And so we look at this and saying we are very easily liquid for the next 2 to 3 years, even if we anticipate new companies starting up to take advantage of this opportunity. Easily our projections say for the next 3 years, we will be able to deal with the upcup, including if all 35,000 students come through. We are okay for the next few years.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, just a comment. According to the Revenue Fiscal on Revenue Office, their review is there is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and it does not have a referral to Ways and Means. So just.
And that's because I would assume that because you've got dedicated revenue and it all matches and it's so not it's doesn't impact any other part of your budget, I would guess, correct?
Well, that's how it's been reviewed by Fiscal and Revenue. So probably, as Mr. Costello explained, the money is there already to do that. It's just a matter of who would get it. Senator Verger, and then we'll go down to the left.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Troy, you probably have thought all of this through, but there's a little bit of an accountability difference in community colleges and public schools and so forth as far as how the money is spent and so forth. And so when you're now subsidizing a private company, what kind of accountability do you have coming back? I see that. I'm not trying to raise problems here, but I just see it as a question that needs to be clarified.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, great question. Currently, most of the programs that exist within Oregon that are meeting or exceeding the current standards are often already under contract to a public sector. And so they're dealing with the financing and the reporting and giving information on their instructors and the cost because they're already under contract to a public entity. So for those that choose to go direct, it really shouldn't be a new burden or a new set of information because they're by routine already doing that for the most part anyway. If it's a new company that's coming in and they're wanting to do this all on their own, this is the only thing they're going to do is offer this course and have nothing to do with the public contractor, the bill and what's listed there gives the safety division ODOT the authority to put in rule the structure that they will follow on financial reporting if they want to partake in the program. Since we already have that financial reporting set up for the public sector, the intent is that's the type of information we would turn around and ask for the private. I am not interested in getting financials from companies on something that has nothing to do with that subsidy. I want to make it very clear that it is around when they're asking for the student subsidy for the ODOT-approved program.
Good. Thank you.
Senator?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Troy, obviously, I want to let you know, I think you do great work, and I appreciate when you come, it's always prepared, and I appreciate that. The crux of this issue, as I understand it, is you're trying to get more seats open. There's more demand. Is that correct? There's more demand for students to take these courses than there are seats in cars for them to do so. So we're trying to expand the possibilities. So we don't have enough bandwidth currently in the system.
To share and answer, George, you are correct. There are situations within the state where currently courses offered and there are more students signing up. So by lottery, they're choosing which kids are coming forward. And those kids can then go to a community college or educational service district or to a private company. So there's that part. The other part exactly is what we're trying to do is offer this up in a way that there are some new start opportunities for private companies, because the number one expense they're going to have is a car. And that, you know, for a small company to get started is a pretty heavy expense to go out with right out of the gate. If they have some sort of assurance that they can offer a course, that the market demand for price, and that they have some assurance that there is an income for the students taught, you know, hopefully will help them get going for small business, which is, you know, the economic backbone of the state with the small companies. And that's in part the intent here, so open up courses and help some new start companies get going.
Okay, Troy, why don't you go ahead and sit aside and see if we need you again. That's Don, I think it's Kreitz, it looks like, and Rich Hansen.
Hello, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Don Kreitz. I'm the president of Oregon Driver Education Center, located here in Salem, Oregon. I've recently served 4 years on the Driver Education Advisory Committee under the Transportation Safety Division. I want to thank you for your consideration of this bill that helps ensure continued high-quality, sustainable driver education for the youth in Oregon. The regulations, current regulations, have increased the quality of instruction. However, it's forced many school districts to turn driver education over to professional instructions such as offered by Oregon Driver Education Center and another company, Oregon Driver Training Institute, which are the two larger schools in Oregon. In 2007, for example, Portland Public Schools became one of a long line of districts to cut driver education from their budget in an effort to ensure student access. Continued student access to driver education, the district contracted with Portland Community College. PCC, in turn, contracted with us, Oregon Driver Education Center, to provide continued continuity of education. Over 2,600 teens, in answer to your question, a partial answer, between ODTI and Oregon Driver Education Center, the two companies serve over 2,600 students this last year through our programs, which represents roughly a third of all the teens who took formal driver education in the state last year. This is conducted in about 45 different schools throughout the state, in addition to Portland Public, also Salem Kaiser, Wilsonville, West Lynn, and Eugene, serviced by ODTI. Our programs are closely regulated by ODOT-TSD, and we continue to be regulated by ODOT-TSD under this bill. We're held to strict standards established by the division, the same standards, as Troy pointed out, that are required of all public institutions offering an ODOT-approved program. In addition, the commercial driving schools are required to only employ professional driving instructors who have had additional certification through DMV and met those testing standards. So the standards, there's even another hoop that commercial driving schools are going through. By allowing commercial driving schools to receive direct reimbursement, you help ensure that driver education is accessible to teens when the public provider determines it has become a liability inconsistent with their core functions and better suited to commercial driving schools. The market, I believe, will determine the relative value of each program. And an economic principle, of course, is that setting a ceiling on tuition could have the unintended consequence of a quality disincentive for companies and or a diminished supply of services to the public. Conclusion, let's continue to reduce the number of injury and fatal collisions among teen drivers by increasing access to affordable driver education made possible by tuition reimbursement for all approved ODOT programs. I believe, in addition, that this also will make it easier for ODOT to oversee programs. So rather than having to oversee 45 separate programs, by working directly with a school such as ours, which is servicing many of these schools, they're able to come in and just monitor our program on their regular audits. It would also become financially feasible to expand to other parts of the state. So, for example, right now, Klamath County has no formal driver education in any schools, community colleges. At this point, it's not financially feasible to expand into those areas. Direct reimbursement would help ensure that it is. So for the continued benefit of the state, I ask you to consider this. Any questions? Or would you like to?
Thank you, Mr. Kreis. I think we'll go to Mr. Hanson here.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. First of all, I wouldn't, Senator George, I do have a PowerPoint presentation on Moose I can do for you if you'd like down the road here. But I do want to say that I represent the Oregon Traffic Safety Education Association. Its membership includes teachers and providers from the public side, which includes educational service districts, community college, public high schools, and also from the commercial driver training side of things, from including people like Don Kreitz and George Doddington and so on. The OTSIA board membership and the board asked that we would go on record of supporting Senate Bill 125 for the following reasons. First of all, we know that automobile crashes are the number leading cause of death and injury in teenagers today. And we also know, secondly, that driver education does make a difference in kids. And in a study done in a school district up in Portland area, it was determined that the kids who took driver education had a lower citation rate, a lower severity of the violation, lower crash rate, and a lower crash severity. So we know that driver education works, and we want to continue to support this. The other thing is that it increases access for students to driver education. As Don mentioned, we have a lot of programs in rural areas, or a lot of people in rural areas that would like to take driver education, but because of the overall cost of starting up a program for 10 or 15 students, it's not feasible to offer a program out in those areas. And so this gives an opportunity for more students to take driver education. The Driver Ed Advisory Committee, of which I'm also a part of, is working diligently to revise and streamline the Oregon administrative rules to address issues of standardization and delivery methods to make sure that all providers who are ODOT TSD approved will measure up to the standards that to the same standards, and also provides the revisions also make sure the providers deliver the best curriculum and the most educationally sound manner. The other thing, too, is that it helps build some infrastructure in the state. The desire of the Driver Education Committee is to see, Driver Education Advisory Committee, is to see driver education for all students prior to licensing. And by providing the reimbursement for all providers, it gives an opportunity to build capacity to get them up to a level where we can deliver that service. And the other thing is, does provide options for providers. Providers now don't have to, I mean, if they want to participate, they can participate in the reimbursement fund. If they don't want to, they don't have to. Or if they want to hybridize and do some students on one end of their business and some students on the other, not being part of that pool, they can do so. Gives options that haven't been there in the past. We obviously have some concerns about monitoring and making sure that it doesn't create an unfair competitive advantage for people out there by having some using this to subsidize parts of their program that aren't ODOT approved. And so obviously we're concerned about that. But I did speak with Troy Costales, and he said that the bill does have in place the opportunity to monitor that and set that up. And so OTSIA is in favor of that and wants to support that. So that being said, Oregon Traffic Safety Education Association is 100% behind this bill.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions?
Any questions? Senator Berger.
You heard my question to Troy, and were you satisfied with his answer?
I am. The billing the within rule and his ability to set those that price ceiling. That's where Don and I would disagree on that. But I feel that, you know, I'm a public provider. I work for Tiger Tualatin School District as well, and we have certain costs that we have to incur, and we are a non-for-profit organization, and therefore we can't we don't compete on that profit level thing. And so I wouldn't like to compete against Don. I would like to work with Don so that we can end up building capacity in our area so that we have more kids taking driver education.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Our last two testifiers, Sandra Bishop and George Doddington, who didn't say whether they're for or against. We're going to find out.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. I apologize for not having copies of our testimony. The building's computer system shut down for a while.
Well, you know, you can always provide it, Mr. Stambridge, later for the file since this is just a public hearing.
I will do that. So thank you for allowing us to come before the committee today. My name is Sandra Bishop, and I'm here representing the Driving School Association of Oregon. And I have with me Mr. George Doddington, who's the president of the association. So I'm going to try to lay out the background, kind of nitty-gritty details of it, and then George will do wrap up and answer any questions. The Driving School Association of Oregon will support this bill if the committee will amend Section 1, Subsection 3, page 1, lines 29 through 30, and page 2, lines 1 through 3, and that's where my expertise runs out, so I'm going to say, and any other sections of the bill that need to be changed to bring it into alignment to allow full reimbursement to commercial driving schools who are providing the state-approved teen driver ed. What we're requesting is that up to the full reimbursement be given to for each individual teen, up to the full reimbursement amount be given to commercial driving schools that are providing those certified state teen driver's ed programs. And just to give you a bit of context here, there are only 3 to 5 commercial driving schools currently providing state-certified teen driver's ed in Oregon. I could be wrong. There could be 6, but it's very few. There are between approximately only 20 to 30 commercial driving schools operating in Oregon who are certified under DMV. And there's approximately, as I think Mr. Kreitz said, approximately 30% of the teen driver's education in Oregon is provided by these commercial driving schools. And in a way, this bill is a solution looking for a problem. In order to provide state-approved teen driver's ed in Oregon, a commercial driving school has to be certified by the Department of Motor Vehicles and then meet a plethora of regulations. There's not enough time in the day to go through all the things that they have to do to present the teen driver's ed. And some of them do it willingly. There are a lot of rules set forth by ODOT and TSD and a lot of extra extensive curriculum development and review and frequent weekend, including Sunday workshops and trainings. Some of these offered through Western Oregon State or Western Oregon University, some through community colleges. There's been a lot of difficulty getting driver's ed instructors trained in Oregon. The courses will be put up and then, you know, they don't get enough people or they decide to change them. So there's been a lot of problems in getting the driver's ed people trained because of the lack of availability of those trainings. It's reasonable for the state to set a limit on the amount of reimbursement that they're willing to give out or believe is appropriate for each student teen driver taking the driver's ed courses. But there's no need for the state to interfere in private business practices. There's no need to pass legislation regulating what a commercial driving school charges for a particular service. As long as the private provider of Teen Driver Zed is in compliance with all the laws and rules, it should qualify for that reimbursement without undue interference in the private business. ODOT TSD setting the reimbursement amount by rule will simply not work, we don't believe, because the state will be forcing a commercial driving school to set a price for a tuition in a teen driver ed program before they know how many students there are going to be, so they will not know what the possible amount of reimbursement will be. If there is not enough reimbursement, it's prorated, so you're going to get 100% if it's there. And as Troy succinctly told you, for the next 3 years, this fund is flush. For the next 3 years, they could afford to pay the full reimbursement for the 35,000 a year who qualify. There's approximately 35,000 sophomores in high schools that are haven't yet got their license that can take driver's ed. So they can already, they're already saying they can afford this. So that's what they should be doing, not trying to set it in rule in a way that is not really going to be, it's not going to be possible for a private business to calculate this if it's set in rule the way this bill is written. Historically, the reimbursement has at times been less than 100%, but it's been a long time ago. In 1995, before TSD took over the program, there was a year when reimbursement went out at less than 100%, substantially less. Some people remember it was around 50%, but I could not find the actual statistic for that, but it was significantly less. And I think that the main thing I want to leave you with today is that to illustrate what I'm talking about, the danger of this bill is that you're actually likely to make teen driver's ed less available in the state. And I want to give you some background data, which is found in the ODOT action plans that are printed once a year. And this will show that the number of providers in the state offering the approved programs and the enrollment levels or the number of teens has been steadily declining. In 1988-99, there were 167 providers of driver's ed in the state. That includes the public providers and the commercial schools, the private providers. Today, there are less than 70. In 98-99, 16,000 students took teen driver's ed. Currently, the number is approximately 8,700. It's a drastic drop. In 2003, these are statistics directly out of Transportation Safety Action Plans published annually. In 2003, there were 10,156 teens that had taken driver's ed. 2004, 9,046. 2005, 9,542. 2006, 9,327. And in 2007, 8,989. Now, last year, before the House committee, there was another bill. There was an identical bill to this. Well, I shouldn't say identical. There was a reimbursement bill last session in the 2007 session, and it went before the House Transportation Committee. It was only 2 pages. This one is 5. We can't quite figure out why. But in that testimony, Troy Gonzalez was quoted as saying that 11,000 out of 35,000 teens were taking the state-certified driver's ed. We don't know where that 11,000 figure came from. And also at that meeting of the House committee last session, Troy offered to supply to the committee a graph or a document that showed a breakdown county by county of exactly how many teen driver's ed providers you had in each county and how many teens in the county were actually taking driver's ed. So if you can ask the department for those kind of statistics, I think you'll understand why we are so nervous about this bill. We are afraid that if you pass this bill, it's really going to... Currently, there's only a few commercial driving schools that have the meet all the criteria, go through all the regulations to deliver a state-certified program. If more regulation and a cap on the price is put for the reimbursement is put here, it will result in fewer commercial driver training schools providing state-certified driver's training in the state. And I know that you can say, well, this isn't mandatory. You know, it's an opportunity for the commercial schools to provide this. The reality is we really need the commercial schools to provide driver's ed training, especially in the rural counties of Oregon. The larger companies are not going to be able to provide driver's ed in the smaller, less densely populated areas of the state. So we really need the commercial folks providing them. So please put no more regulations on, and if you're going to give a reimbursement, simply make it fair and equitable and give the full reimbursement to everyone for the next 3 years at least. Thank you. And George will wrap up and take questions.
Okay. You wrap up and then we'll have a couple questions.
I'm George Doddington. I am the president of Driving School Association of Oregon. I'm the president of Oregon Driver Training Institute, and I'm also a committee member on the Driver Education Advisory Committee. Chair Metzger and the committee, thanks for having me here and hearing what I have to say. Driving School Association of Oregon supports this bill if it is amended to exclude the tuition limit for a commercial driver training school. We request that up to full reimbursement amount be given to commercial driver training schools that are providing state-certified driver education. The current market has always driven the rate for services in all aspects of commercial enterprise. As long as a private provider of teen driver education is in compliance with all the criteria specified by law and rule, it should qualify for the reimbursement. The state reimbursement for driver education programs is directly affected by the actual number of students that complete the division-approved program during the associated year. There is no way to determine the reimbursement amount that providers will receive prior to the end of the driver ed year. As mentioned, the reimbursement may fluctuate. ODOT-TSD has no business telling private providers that what they can charge for their services. The rate should not be determined in Oregon administrative rule. As you have heard, commercial drivers training schools are regulated extensively by DMV as well as ODOT-TSD if they provide a state-certified teen driver education program. There are only a few commercial driver schools that have all the criteria in place to be able to deliver a state-certified program. If more regulation is imposed on the commercial driving schools, it will result in fewer commercial driver training schools providing state-certified driver ed.
Okay, thank you. So let me just understand this a little bit. Right now you get no reimbursement. You'd rather have no reimbursement and go to the current system than allow you to have an opportunity to choose to take a reimbursement or not have a reimbursement. That's what it sounds like.
Chair Metzger.
It sounds rather bizarre to me. So if you could briefly explain, if I've misinterpreted you, I'd like...
Chair Metzger, thank you. No, we are not saying that we want no reimbursement.
Well, you don't have it now.
We don't have it now, and we're asking for equity. We're asking for the full reimbursement amount. And what we are resisting and opposed to is having the reimbursement amount set in administrative rule.
Well, currently the program has an amount set,
$210. I misspoke. George corrected me. What we're objecting to is having the price or the tuition for that service set in administrative rule. That's what...
If you want to qualify for this program, but you're not required to qualify that, you can continue to operate now and say that your services are better and children would rather go to you, whatever center. But by the way, is the Oregon Driver Education Center that Don Kreitz just spoke of, is he a part of your organization?
No, he's not.
Okay. All right. So you're driving schools at other driving schools. So not everybody is in the same boat here.
Chair Metzger, I believe we have about 11 or 12 members, about half, close to half of the driving schools in the state. A little bit less than half of the driving schools in the state belong to the association.
Okay, all right. Questions for these folks? Senator Berger.
Chair, I guess what I would, I'm a little confused by your position. You would be accepting state reimbursement money. We go through that all the time. If we accept federal money, then we have to obey by the rules. If you don't want to have any limit to what you charge, you just simply don't accept the reimbursement and you charge whatever you want to charge. So clarify somehow. I'm confused about that.
Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, I believe that we're under enough regulation, you know, and we are in full compliance of all the rules set. And I'm not sure where any inequity would be as far as getting receiving more funds if we're delivering the program under all of the criteria. Then we should qualify for the reimbursement amount that's determined, you know, annually through the fund.
Sure.
And I'm not sure why they'd want to put a cap on what we can ask for the program. I don't understand the reasoning behind putting a tuition cap for the commercial providers when. If we have to establish a tuition, we have to factor in the potential of a reduced reimbursement fund due to proration. You know, I mean, we're solving now, but if this is in law, and then we do have a lot of students that, you know, that take the program and it becomes a prorate, that particular reimbursement number becomes a prorated number, and then we haven't, you know, and then we're under a established cap, it could create a situation where we could lose money, you know, if we haven't, you know, if we're unable to put our tuition rate at a level we're comfortable with.
Follow up, please. Yes, sir, I understand that, except that you don't have to accept all the students. I take my daughter to you, and you say, I'm sorry, our classes are full, and then more students you take, the more reimbursement money you get. So from a business standpoint, I don't quite understand, because you are a private business. So it is not like a public entity. In fact, I see that you have more flexibility than the public entity.
Chair Metzger and Senator Berger, we compete right now. I mean, without having the reimbursement funds, our cost of providing a program is substantially more than what the normal tuitions are in the state right now. So I cannot have a program outside of a school district program that could be competitive with what's going on if you put the $210 number in, you know, involved with the actual price of providing the service. So I can't compete in my own area against the schools because they're getting the extra $210. So their tuition rates are adjusted accordingly. So if I were to want to just have the program, it would be $200 more to take my program that isn't reimbursed for, you know, so the community is not going to now want to take our program because they can get it for $200 less through the school district. Whereas if we're given a chance, you know, because we're providing the same service and we're given the reimbursement chance, then we can go ahead and lower the tuition rate to something that's affordable for the students. And we believe that the market would determine a fair tuition amount. I mean, if we charge too much, they're not going to come. You know, they're not going to come to our program. They can get it for less at the school districts.
follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Well, not necessarily. I think part of the thinking here is to try to give people who want to take the training an opportunity to take it, and so by expanding it to the sector that you serve, then more students would be able to take the classes. I'm really not in favor of government having a lot of say in private business. Believe me, I've been in private business just about all my adult life. But I'm a little confused here as to your opposition. I'm sorry if I don't understand it, but I am a little confused by it.
Let me go to Senator George. Thank you, Senator Verger.
Mm-hmm. One other question, kind of a couple questions, if I could. Have a little leniency, Mr. Chair. Okay. What are the regulatory differences that you're seeing between this bill and what's current law? Like, to meet this criteria that's in this bill, what's the regulatory difference that you actually have a question about?
Chair Metzger and Senator George, there is no difference. The criteria set for the program, what is being delivered, has all of the rules in place for standard driver education, and we're providing that service through contracts with the school district in order to, and they're the ones that collect the tuitions, and they're the ones that get the reimbursement. If we were, this bill is out there to allow us to apply for the reimbursement directly. And then, so I could have a Saturday program right in my office instead of contracting with a school district.
Okay, I think I'm starting to understand, Mr. Mesker, if I could. Okay, so let's just make up some numbers here. I have no idea what a course costs. But let's say, for instance, you currently charge $600 to students to provide your course. And currently, your competitor charges $550. But in your course, you offer it in places like Lakeview, or some other enhancement. Maybe you give an extra day of classes or whatever. You view that your product is worth $50 more than your competitor's product because you provide some kind of enhancement of some sort, and people are picking your business. What you're saying is that if we go under a structure like this bill is creating, in essence, everybody has to meet the minimum amount of rules that are currently out there, and you do. So therefore, you should get the reimbursement. But what this would do is stifle innovation, is what I think you're trying to say, that you couldn't offer services above and beyond and may charge more for it, because if you did, you'd be outside of the cap. Am I correct with that?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, not exactly. What we're looking at here is just providing the 36 and 6, the set criteria of the program. It's not about enhancing it or anything else. It's just a matter of delivering the same division-approved course, on our own, instead of having to go through a school district. School districts are receiving the subsidy and setting their tuition accordingly. And we want to be able to receive the subsidy and establish our tuition accordingly as well. We just want to be on an even playing field. What the department wants to do is put in place a tuition cap, and then have the provider expose financial records to verify, for what purpose. I'm really not sure. As far as, because if we meet all of the criteria that governs the program, then why would they want to put a cap on how much we can charge for it? The program's not required for students to take.
Okay. So let me ask another question. So what you're in essence saying then is that there may be that you find some type of efficiencies. Like, for instance, hypothetically, you make a deal with General Motors that you drive General Motors cars. I'm just talking hypothetically.
May not be a good idea right now.
I'm just saying, because we need every subsidy we can at General Motors right now. You make a deal with General Motors that for every student that gets trained in General Motors car that you're operated in, they'll give you a $50 advantage to that. You could work out a deal with General Motors to advertise their cars, and therefore it would lower your price by $50. But under the cap, you wouldn't. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that you may find some efficiencies that other driving schools cannot, for some reason or other, like what I'm talking about here. And what this would do is that even though you all produce at some number, what you'd be doing is that you would be taking away some opportunities for individual schools to be innovative. Am I being correct here on their pricing? But, I mean, because at some point what you're saying is, and I understand it, I'm opposed to price caps as a general rule. So that's the only thing in this bill that makes me nervous. So I'm with you. But typically the reason why you oppose price caps is because somebody has a competitive advantage in pricing, like, for instance, getting a subsidy from General Motors for driving General Motors cars and pitching those to the students, or because you're smarter and you hire people who, for some reason, get more students through in a more cost-effective manner. There's some competitive advantage. So that's why you don't want price caps to stifle innovation, and I'm with you. But I'm not understanding exactly why you're arguing what you're arguing, because when I keep asking the traditional oppositions to price caps, you're saying no. And so I'm trying to figure out what advantage you're trying to get at that would be stifling with the price cap. Because, I mean, philosophically, I'm with you.
I'm going to take a stab at this.
Okay.
Chair Metzger and Senator George, I think there's a much more... You're thinking in a much more sophisticated way about this pricing. I think one of the main problems with may not charge tuition an amount greater than, and then you flip to the top of page 2, for a commercial driving school, an amount determined by the department by rule. It's not about advantage. It's not about enhancements. It's about actually staying in business and being able to recover the cost of providing the program. It's not about a big profit here. And I think that the point that I want to leave you with here is, Troy said it, most often already under contract to a public entity. So George and also Mr. Kreitz have very large driving schools. They're not affected by this. They're already under contract to the public schools. So the Driving School Association of Oregon also includes small members, some of whom have already given up trying to provide teen driver ed programs certified by the state because they simply can't go through all the regulatory hoops and hassles. And we should have brought the curriculum book, which is this thick, and you'd begin to understand. They can't get their driving instructors trained in a timely manner to get them on the road with the kids. So you're having fewer and fewer of the smaller schools who are the independents, the commercial driving schools who used to provide services outside of the heavily populated areas. So I think the objection to a price cap is just because there's no predictability that you can even meet the costs that you will put out to provide the program.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I could.
One more.
Okay. I think I've got it. Now I actually think I understand it. So what's happening is there are certain large established schools that have contracts with school districts that are, in essence, guaranteeing them a certain level of profitability through proportion. You know, economies of scale. Startups are having a difficult time because they don't have that competitive advantage of having a contract with a school that, in essence, guarantees a certain baseline of customers and a certain throughput that's guaranteed by contract. So what's happening, as I understand now, is that, in essence, what this does, what you're saying this line, page 2, line 3 does, is, in essence, caps it so you'll continue to have the established schools that have the contracts already in place. It will give them a competitive advantage because, in essence, what's happened, they've got the contracts with the schools, and the small independents then don't have that, and that means their levels of students go up, fluctuate more often. Therefore, their costs are unpredictable. Therefore, a set price cap doesn't work. Am I understanding that now correctly?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I wish I'd said all those things. No, I can follow through on some of your logic. I just want to say it's not about startups necessarily, though the startup companies that are trying to do a commercial driving school and want to provide teen driver ed certified by the state would fall into that category. But our concern from our members has been putting existing commercial schools out of the business of providing teen driver's ed. This is a safety issue. This is not a matter of commerce. The people that are providing teen driver's ed are doing so because they're experienced and they have the same intention and the same motivation that TSD has, that you have for traffic safety. This is about training teens. So all we're saying, and I think what we have to leave you with, is that if you pass this bill, you will be restricting and limiting the availability of teen driver ed programs in the state. So if there's a way that you can find a way to make it equitable and simply settle on the full reimbursement amount going back to the private providers as well as the publics, then it's fine. If not, I would advise you not to pass this, because you're going to be forcing people out of business who now have the opportunity to provide some teen driver's ed, and you'll be forcing everyone will be forced to contract with a public school to provide driver's ed in Oregon.
Okay. What we're going to have for this one. Thank you, folks. I got maximum of 5 minutes left on this issue. Is there anybody else want to testify on this bill? Mr. Kreitz, I will give you one opportunity if you want to rebut anything, since you're another private provider, if you want, but briefly, just then we're going to move on to the next issue.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, in response to your comments, I agree wholeheartedly. The points I was making in my testimony were an attempt to say, yes, a price cap would result in those economic principles coming into play that would put a damper on innovation. It would put a damper on quality, in essence, and that's what price caps do. So I would concur with your thoughts on that, and it's for those reasons that I would oppose putting on a price ceiling.
So, Mr. Chairman, so the line that they were talking about in the bill that puts the price caps, you're in support of the overall bill, but you would prefer if we took that price cap out.
That's correct.
I got you. Okay.
Well, you still get the $210. I mean, you're not going to get any more money than $210.
That's understood.
Yeah. Because there was someone else that just whatever we charge, we want to, you know, was the message, we charge as much as we want, you just pay us.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, Medicaid, Medicare, nobody does that. I mean, we're talking about public money, you know, you make a decision to either go under that or you go under a different plan. Or
right. Okay. The tuition rates would be based on the recognition that the 210 is the limit.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, sir. Thank you. We'll hash this over later. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 125. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 127. Jim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill has to do with suspensions of driver's licenses of individuals involved in uninsured motor vehicle collisions. It clarifies the responsibilities for individuals to show proof of compliance with financial responsibility requirements.
Lana Coley, ODOT, DMV, please.
I might also mention you have the Dash 1 amendment, which clarifies offense of failure to make future responsibility filings, and it adds a risk retention group for among the allowed insurers.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Afternoon, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Lana Coley. I'm the Program Services Manager at DMV within ODOT. I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 127, which is amending or repealing various statutes dealing with financial responsibility related to the ownership and operation of motor vehicles. The bill has three goals as we see it. The first is to remove provisions of the law that are obsolete, old, or impractical for us to administer. The second is to clarify provisions that cause confusion for DMV, the public, the insurance industry, and law enforcement. And then the third is to bring balance in the treatment of owners and drivers who violate financial responsibility or insurance laws, and to do it in a way that is the most likely to achieve compliance with insurance requirements. What I'd like to do is go briefly through each of the sections, and then we also I'll talk about those amendments in the sections as they pertain to. So Section 1, that's to remove language that allows a person to send a statement to DMV telling us that their vehicle's not being continuously operated on the highways. And what we've done is we've clarified it to say that if a vehicle's being operated on the highways, it has to be insured. If it's not being operated, it doesn't have to be insured. And then we've also added the premises open to the public to be consistent with other statutes that use that along with highways. Section 2, we're removing the language that requires us to notify the county DA of our belief that a person that's residing in our county is driving uninsured or has provided false insurance information. It's information we've never provided to the county DAs, and they've never asked us for it, and I'm assuming they probably don't want it. Section 3 is... Section 3 and 4 both are to put timelines in the statute for the insurance industry to notify us or to respond to us. One of them is we sent a request to ask them to verify whether the insurance information provided on the accident form is accurate or not. And then the other one is that they're supposed to notify us if they're aware of someone who's driving uninsured or isn't in an uninsured accident. And neither one of those have any time frames for them to do that in. So in the past, they've been like months and years later. Section 5, that's another place that we proposed being amended. And what we intended to do there was currently the statute requires the person to provide proof of insurance even if they're in an accident that is not reportable. The reporting requirements changed in 2003, but this piece still requires a person to provide proof of insurance to us even though they don't have to submit an accident report. And there's really no way for us to know that they were in an accident to even request that they provide that proof of insurance. So we intended to clean that up, but in the drafting, the unintended change that was made was it removed the requirement for all owners to file an SR-22. We did not intend to do that. Currently, both the driver and the owner have to file an SR-22. The way it was drafted, only the driver has to do that. So we wanted to fix that and make it back to where it was for both the owner and the driver, as well as our fix to deal with the conflict on the reporting requirements. Section 6 is simply to make it clear that what's satisfactory for the requirement of filing an SR-22. Section 7 is to clarify that when you are filing an SR-22 because you've received a hardship permit, once that hardship permit expires, the SR-22 requirement expires for that hardship permit. Section 8 is simply to align Oregon law with the new proposed national standard for the date on the SR-22 certificates. And then Section 9 is the amendment, another amendment, where we want to add the risk retention groups to that language, and that was done at the request of the insurance division within DCBS. And we removed old language and added clarification to what insurers we can accept SR-22 certificates from. Section 10, our intent with that is to penalize people the same, whether you're a driver or an owner of the vehicle. At first look, it could appear that we're softening the penalty to those drivers. But currently, if you're a driver and you're involved in an uninsured accident, you get a mandatory one-year suspension. But if you own the vehicle that you didn't have insured and you let somebody else drive it, you only have to file the SR-22. Or if you're driving a vehicle and you're convicted of driving uninsured, you have to file an SR-22. So this is the only situation that you have a mandatory one-year suspension. So what we are proposing to do is to change it to make it equal for everybody. The penalty is the same. You file an SR-22. With the goal of getting everybody insured, because that's what the SR-22 does. Now, if they don't file the SR-22, they're going to receive a suspension anyway. But if they do, then they have the vehicle insured and they're driving with insurance versus getting suspended for a year, driving with a suspended license and without insurance. Okay. So our goal is to try to get compliance with the insurance requirements.
Okay.
Section 11 just removes a statute reference that's related to bond and deposit options, and those were removed in 2003, and that statute got missed somehow. Section 12 and 13 is related to Section 10 that I just talked about, because there's references in the statute that need to be cleaned up along with Section 10. And then Section 14 is the actual repeal of the statutes related to the bond and deposits. And then another statute in Section 1 that needs to be removed based on the change in Section 1. So we would appreciate your support of this bill, and I'm open to any questions.
Ms. Colley, thank you. I always like it when we repeal things that are no longer operable, you know, kind of, you know, that's good. It's amazing how many things we always find that are on statute that, or like, why do we have this? We never do it. I also like the idea of, I was unaware of how long sometimes it is to get information on insurance. You know, people get suspended and, you know, they can't get their you know, they maybe wouldn't have been suspended, but, they, you know, the insurance company doesn't verify that. I also appreciate in Section 10 the removing the mandatory 1-year suspension for your driver, you're not the owner, and trying to work for compliance and just see that they get insured. So it's just because you lent me a car, I thought you were covered, and I'm suspended and I have no option. That seems much more in tune to try and to, you know, just make sure people are covered rather than just suspend, you know, people. So questions from the committee? Do I take that? This is only a public hearing today, but just for Ms. Culley's purposes, is there any particular heartburn about this bill? Okay, we will bring it back when we have a work session soon. You did a great job. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 127, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 129. Mr. Stembridge, last bill, then we'll do some committee introductions.
Senator Metzger and members of the committee, Senate Bill 129 increases the penalty for violation of an Oregon Department of Transportation out-of-service order, and it increases the suspension of commercial driver's license for first violation of an ODOT out-of-service order. It increases the penalty on employer of commercial motor vehicle operators who violated ODOT out-of-service order if the employer knowingly allowed the violation. It prohibits ODOT from issuing a commercial driver's license with hazardous materials endorsements to an individual who is not a U.S. citizen or permanent legal resident, and it makes related changes to the commercial driving regulation. This also declares an emergency effect upon passage. There is an amendment in the works, but we have not gotten it back.
Well, I'm sure Mr. McClellan will tell us what it is. Mr. McClellan, please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I am the DMV Administrator at the Department of Transportation, and I am here to testify on Senate Bill 129. Hopefully all questions will be answered in due time. This is proposed legislation of the Department of Transportation to comply with federal laws and regulations relating to the driving privileges of commercial motor vehicle operators. It also includes some changes to clarify statutes and to remove, as the previous bill, some inconsistencies to clarify what is required. Going back to 1986, that's when the federal government passed the Commercial Motor Vehicle Safety Act and established national standards for commercial motor vehicle operations to achieve greater consistency among the states and to reduce truck and bus crashes in this country. Each state administers its own commercial driver licensing program based upon the federal laws and regulations that set those standards for testing and licensing commercial motor vehicle operators. It's the one area in a state's driver licensing programs where there is a federal mandate, federal oversight, setting minimum requirements. The regular Class C passenger vehicle or passenger driver's licenses are not regulated by the federal government. The CDL program also disqualifies drivers that fail to meet the standards or commit specific offenses identified in those federal regulations and in Oregon statutes. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration regulates the operations under their authority with the Department of Transportation, U.S. Department of Transportation. They ensure compliance with commercial driver licensing standards for the drivers, the motor carriers, and the states. And those standards are specified in the regulations, and they are revised frequently. And if you've been around the Capitol a few times, you have probably seen this type of bill come before you before. It seems like every 2 years we bring to you a cleanup type bill to bring Oregon statutes in alignment with the federal laws and regulations. And we are back again with this bill. I will point out there are penalties associated with noncompliance. You can get to the point where the federal government can withhold a portion of the federal aid highway funds, including the Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program funds, and a portion of that funds Oregon State Police activities. They can also withhold first-time 5% or second-time 10% of a state's federal highway funds if you continue to be deemed substantially noncompliant.
ultimately they could withhold and withdraw a state's authority to issue commercial driver licenses in the state. So that's the big hammer. That's the extreme that they could go to. I'd like to also go through each section of this bill and explain what is in there so you understand what's in the bill. Starting with Section 2, this portion deals with farm endorsements. In the last full legislative session in 2007, the legislature gave our department the authority to impose CDL suspensions for drivers who operate commercial motor vehicles under a farm endorsement. This was done in response to a federal compliance review that we had in 2004. However, the legislation did not include authority to cancel the farm endorsement when the CDL is suspended. The farm endorsement is attached to the Class C license. It's separate from the CDL license. So this gets a little confusing pretty quickly as we go through this. But there is a difference between the farm endorsement and the CDL. And that's what we're getting at here. So as an example, this means that a driver with a CDL who's suspended for failing a breath test while operating a commercial motor vehicle, they could continue to operate the commercial motor vehicle under the authority of their farm endorsement. So technically they could say, I've got the farm endorsement, I'm okay, even though we've canceled their CDL license. We see that as a loophole, basically. According to the federal regulations, that farm endorsement must be suspended whenever the CDL or the right to the CDL is suspended for offenses that are specified in Oregon statutes and federal regulations. I'm going to do some additional research and determine what types of offenses would apply to that farm endorsement. I really don't know exactly how that particular piece works. There are about 16,000 individuals in Oregon right now who have both the commercial driver license and a farm endorsement, and our estimate is about 4% of those people would fall into this category of having a CDL that's been suspended, who also would have the farm endorsement suspended for that same reason. So that's Section 2. Sections 3 and 7 deal with gross vehicle weight ratings and the actual gross combination weight of these rigs. A CDL is required to operate a commercial motor vehicle. The current definition includes a gross vehicle weight rating, or GVWR, of 26,001 pounds or more, as specified by the manufacturer. Under the current statutes, a driver could load a vehicle of less than 2,001 pounds to a weight that exceeds that and not be required to possess a CDL. Federal regulations regulations indicate that the CMV definition, which should include the gross vehicle weight rating or the actual gross weight, whichever is greater. The definition of a CMV proposed in this bill mirrors the federal language that we've received from them and will discourage the overloading of the lighter vehicles to avoid CDL requirements. Also in Sections 3 and 7, we're proposing the removal of language that was inadvertently left in the statutes in 2007 relating to the operation of mass transit vehicles, public transit vehicles. In 2007, references to mass transit vehicles were inadvertently left in the definition of a commercial motor vehicle. We believe the legislature intended to stop requiring a CDL for operators of mass transit vehicles except when the vehicle exceeds the 20,001 pounds or carries more than 16 passengers. However, the remaining language should be removed because it could be interpreted to require a CDL whenever a mass transit vehicle is operated, regardless of its size or passengers that it's carrying. So again, a cleanup we believe is necessary in the statutes. Sections 4 and 5 deal with to hold a CDL. Seems like a pretty clear phrase, but we've had some problems with the interpretation of that. Federal regulations define when a CDL disqualification is necessary, and they prohibit deferring or masking convictions or allowing diversion for a person who holds a CDL. Oregon law uses the phrase, holds a valid CDL. That's what we have in the statutes. That's what the federal regulations also have. But the word valid has led to some different interpretations when cases have been brought to the courts. In one case, a judge allowed diversion for a CDL holder since the driver's medical certificate had expired. So in essence, the claim was because the medical certificate was not valid, was not active and could be used, that it automatically would cause the commercial driver license to be invalidated. which is not the same. They're two different things. One is a card used to driving the vehicle. The other is a requirement to get in behind the wheel and to operate the vehicle, such as just similar to insurance or other types of requirements to operate the vehicle. So they're two different things. The case went to the Supreme Court. They agreed with our argument. Nevertheless, we think just a simple removal of the word valid from the statute will help, and then through rulemaking we'll be able to clarify even further if necessary. That provision has an emergency clause and is effective upon passage. Section 6, dealing with military purposes. Under federal regulation, anyone who operates a commercial vehicle for military purposes is exempt from CDL requirements. However, in current Oregon law, we improperly limit this exemption by requiring that the driver have an out-of-state license or a permit that's been issued by the armed forces. This section removes those conditions in compliance with the federal regulations. Section 8 deals with hazardous materials endorsements. The federal regulations require that an applicant for a hazardous material endorsement provide proof of U.S. citizenship or lawful presence, lawful permanent residence in the United States. And under current Oregon law, an applicant must prove legal, permanent, or temporary residence as part of a federal TSA, Transportation Safety Administration, background check. This section removes the eligibility for those individuals who are here temporarily in the United States. So we had to bring a legal presence bill back for you to...
I noticed that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Section 9, suspension lengths. In 2007, the duration of driver license suspensions for failure to appear and failure to comply for people who do not have CDL drivers were increased to 10 years or until they comply, whichever is earlier. The same changes were not made on the CDL, in the CDL statutes. This section of the bill increases those suspensions for CDLs for failure to appear and failure to comply to 10 years or until compliance to be consistent with those drivers who are not driving a CDL, for non-CDL suspensions. In Section 9, it provides a definition for conviction. A recent audit that we received from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration indicated that Oregon should define conviction as it pertains to a CDL disqualifying offense. The definition that they use ensures that states have authority to disqualify a commercial vehicle operator or CDL holder for all offenses described in federal regulations. They believe the ordinary definition of a conviction is not applicable. For example, the ordinary definition does not include failure to appear in court per a summons or the failure to pay a fine or court cost, failure to appear or failure to comply. The federal agency believes this creates the possibility of a driver challenging a disqualification on the basis that he or she was not convicted and may not be disqualified under Oregon law, and that would happen in another state. We believe we have the authority for the failure to appear or failure to comply within Oregon. It would be in other states that argument might be put forward. I'm not aware of any cases where that's happened, but it's a risk. So it's recommended that we make this change in Section 9. Section 10 deals with law enforcement authority. Some law enforcement officials have questioned their statutory authority to cite an out-of-state CMV operator for driving while suspended or revoked when their CDL is suspended or revoked in a state other than Oregon. Instead, the officer may cite the driver for operating without driving privileges. However, a conviction for operating without driving privileges doesn't result in a federally mandated CDL disqualification like driving while suspended or driving while revoked. This section specifies that the offense of driving while suspended or driving while revoked includes operating a commercial motor vehicle in Oregon while their driving privileges have been suspended or are suspended or revoked in another state. This change ensures that law enforcement can properly cite the drivers and that the federally mandated CDL disqualification is imposed. Sections 11, 12, and 13 deal with out-of-service orders. Law enforcement and motor carrier division's enforcement officials may prohibit operation of a CMV by issuing a vehicle or driver out-of-service order if it is determined the vehicle or the driver is violating applicable safety standards or laws. FMCSA regulations increased the mandatory civil penalties and commercial driver license suspension periods for violating these out-of-service orders in July of 2007, so after the last legislative session, full legislative session. These sections raised the penalties in Oregon to match the minimum federal requirements, and they removed redundant and incorrect penalty language in current statutes. We are working on some amendments to this bill. We still don't have the language back on those. I'd like to just touch on what those deal with for your benefits and what they are. The first deals with, this is the last topic I just mentioned. The Attorney General's Office has recommended that we repeal ORS 813-052 and create a separate section in Chapter 825 to actually deal with the civil penalties for violating an out-of-service notice. They're concerned that in the way the bill is currently drafted, it could be read as limiting or removing the authority of the Motor Carrier Safety Division to impose out-of-service orders. So it's really more of a statutory cleanup in this construct of the bill. The Second Amendment removes the term knowingly as a condition for suspending a CDL held by someone who violates an out-of-service order. The use of the term knowingly results in a lower standard than is allowable under the federal regulations. So there's a difference between knowingly violating something and simply violating something. And that's the concern being that by having knowingly, it's actually a lower standard than what the minimum the federal regulations would require. So the proposal is to take that word out in the amendment. And then the final area for amendment deals with very, very new regulations that came out just last month. They require a state to ensure that a person's medical certificate is current and valid while they hold a CDL. So it would actually change the law that I talked about a minute ago dealing with medical certificates. Currently, state motor vehicle agencies are required to verify that a person has a valid medical certificate only at the time the CDL is issued or when it's renewed. So essentially every 8 years, we're required that our responsibility is the DMV is only every 8 years when they're renewing. Under the new regulations, states must receive and maintain a copy of the medical certificate and then cancel CDL privileges whenever the medical certificate expires or is determined to be invalid. Federal regulations describe a 2-year phased-in process beginning in January of 2012, so expectation that the state would be fully compliant by January of 2014. What we are proposing, because that is a ways out and they're still working out the details of these particular regulations, we are requesting authority to set the effective date of the administrative rule rather than specify a start date in the statute, but have the authority to start it by January 2012 and to apply for any federal grants that may be available for us to pay for that change, to start the IT work, the systems work that we may need to put that in place, and not wait until the 2011 session for that. Between now and then, we would work with the industry and the federal government to really understand and the requirements and to put those into place. So it's a law that would take effect in 2012. We would like the authority to move ahead with that implementation with the understanding it will take 3 years probably to get that put in place. That's a significant change for us and for the drivers. So, in summary, the changes proposed in Senate Bill 129 are necessary to bring Oregon into compliance with federal laws and regulations. We believe it reduces the risk of losing federal highway funds, clarifies confusing standards, removes inconsistencies in the statutes, and we believe it has also some public safety enhancements to it. And we request your support of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. That was a lot. Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask you a clarification question in Section 13. You removed knowingly, but the fine there is very substantial increase, and I don't know if that means because removing knowingly lowers the class, is that what that does? Or is the $25,000 fine subjected because of the class that it is in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, that would be the maximum civil penalty that we could assess. if the person committed that same violations that we have in place today. So it goes from a range of $2,750 to $11,000 to a maximum of $25,000. That is consistent with the penalties that the federal regulations require as a maximum penalty for that.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair. All right, so you've removed the $11,000.
Yes.
Have you, and you have not removed the $2,700?
Right. That's true. That's
okay.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And how did knowingly have anything to do with the fine change?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Nobody else signed up to testify. Matt Kirker's in here. Anybody else have any comments on this bill?
My understanding, Mr. Chair, is that we have to do this. And
yeah, but I wanted to see if this is, you know, I didn't want to hear anything later. So
call up the opponents.
Nope. Okay. All right. They thought. They moved.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, from the record, my name is Bob Russell, President of the Oregon Trucking Association, and I have with me Andy Eno from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. He can answer questions that you might have, and when these bills come up every year, or every session, and basically what they are is cleanup bills. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration does an audit of DMV periodically to make sure that their statutes are in compliance with the federal regulations. The federal government has basically preempted the states in the area of truck safety and truck licensing. So they govern. And what happens is DMV comes in with this bill. It looks like it's got lots of changes, and nobody understands it. But, in fact, it's a requirement that grew out of the audit that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration performed of ODOT, and it just all it does is it makes Oregon statutes consistent with the federal regulations that govern our lives.
Right. I think it's valuable that you have that on the record since we weren't signed up, you know, since you are those who are regulated.
Right.
You know, is to have that on the record. So you don't have any particular issues with either how Mr. McClellan articulated the bill or...
I do not have any issues with the current bill. I have not seen the amendments, so yeah. I would like to reserve judgment until I see the amendments.
And what I would suggest, Mr. McClellan, as you prepare those amendments, would you share them with the industry so that by the time we come for work session, you guys are on the same page, and then we'll move the bill at that time. Does that sound okay?
Thank you. Yes. Mr. Chairman, those amendments were ordered through committee staff, and we will take care of doing
great.
That.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 129. We're going to open a work session, possible introduction of committee measures. We have a couple here, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have legislative draft 1567 related to tax increment financing at rural airports, and we have legislative draft 2104 relating to regulation of credit unions. I have copies if any member would like them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move we approve as committee bills LC 1567 and LC 2104.
Senator Starr has moved that we introduce as committee bills LC 1567 and LC 2104. And again, this does not indicate support or opposition and may not even come to this committee, but we will introduce them. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So order. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.